Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States. Episode 5.24, The Report on Public Credit. In large part, the first congressional session in 1789 had been all about establishing a new government. The Constitution provided a broad framework for what the government should look like. However, beyond that, it gave little in the way of pragmatic details. It was the scaffolding on which the structure was built. But if the drafters had been engineers and architects, then that first bunch of congressmen were the construction crew. When the first session of Congress adjourned at the end of September, things were coming along nicely. Madison had wrapped up his work on the Bill of Rights, which was now off to be considered by the states. The new government was quickly seeing what worked, and just as importantly, what didn't work, and were busy setting new precedents based on these lessons. By 1790, however, things would become different. The government was up and running enough now to be functional. Historians Eric McKittrick and Stanley Elkins write in their book, The Age of Federalism, that a concept of first things first had come to dominate the nation's politics. Going back to the Revolution, before anything else that we need to take care of, they had to take care of the British. With that done and out of the way, okay, now we have an economic disaster and an impotent government that needs replacing. Great. Then comes the Constitution, ratification, and most recently, the implementation of that new government. Were there speed bumps along the way? Of course, we've spent a lot of time here talking about those. However, even while resistance existed, there seemed to be a general understanding that there was always that one last hurdle that they needed to get over. If not outright united, which is probably going too far, there was a general sense that the mission at hand was securing the country and indeed the revolution. But then 1790 came around and things began to change. The government was operational. It had sufficient legitimacy, largely because of Washington, and it had created those all-important departments. The question that was left, and the one that would come to dominate politics for the next decade, was what the direction of the country was going to be. Sure, the United States was stable enough for the moment, but that question of what direction the country was going to take, well, that remained very much open. The battles over this are going to completely and permanently change the American political system. Political parties were going to quickly emerge. Former friends would be transformed into bitter rivals and enemies. As the United States entered into the final decade of the 18th century, it would embark on a path of intense partisan fighting. As Alexander Hamilton was busily working away on his report for public credit in late 1789, our main topic for today, George Washington was hard at work trying to stitch the country together. Washington was well aware of his own personal force. He was easily the biggest figure in the United States, and really, how could it be any other way? He was already being called the father of the country before he stepped foot in office. Even had he not served as the president, Washington would have still taken on legendary qualities in the public mind. Knowing that, and knowing that he was going to be the president over the entire country, George Washington decided to head out and see personally how the country was dealing with these changes. With Congress done for the year, Washington decided upon a tour of New England. The journey for Washington actually got off to a pretty rough start, at least from his perspective. The president received, as he would throughout the trip, a very warm reception. When he rolled into Boston, everybody was thrilled to greet the president, the father of the country, and welcome him into town. Well, almost everybody. John Hancock, who was the governor of Massachusetts, failed to do the polite thing and offer up his mansion to the president. Furthermore, Hancock had not even bothered to officially welcome Washington. Although Hancock did decide to extend an invite to Washington to have dinner at the governor's mansion, an offended George Washington declined. Now, in pretty short order, Samuel Adams would do his best to patch up this rift, telling Washington that Hancock was stricken by gout, and that's why he failed to come. in order to really sell things. Hancock paid Washington a visit the next day, being carried in on a stretcher to see the commander-in-chief. Now, we really should not speculate on Hancock's health on the day of Washington's visit. However, I do have to wonder if Hancock might have had a pang of jealousy or annoyance when it came to Washington. After all, Hancock had been standing in his shadow for years. All the way back at the beginning of the Second Continental Congress, it had been Hancock who wanted command over the army. But there was Washington, showing up looking all spiffy in his uniform. Just a few years earlier, Samuel Adams had insinuated to Hancock that if he were to support the ratification of the Constitution, and in the event that Virginia did not ratify, Hancock would be a pretty good fit as the first president. Of course, though, Virginia did ratify, and now here he was, having to call upon Washington. There were some other minor annoyances along the way for Washington. He decided to go visit Israel Putnam, for instance, only to find out that he didn't live where Washington thought that he did. Likewise, for a period of the trip in Massachusetts, Washington was dealing with a flu epidemic that spread through Boston. During this time, he would also catch up with some old friends, including a fishing trip with John Sullivan, who, for possibly the first and only time in our story, appears without getting outflanked. Aside from those few hiccups along the way, the trip did prove to be a success for the president. He had received warm receptions everywhere that he went. What he observed was that the people were generally pretty happy with the new government, which by extension meant that they were pretty pleased with his performance. As Washington wrapped up 1789, therefore, he found himself pretty happy with the first year of his new administration. Things were going as well as could be hoped, and by the end of the year, he even had a bit of free time. It's not surprising, then, based on this, that Washington was entering into 1790 with high hopes that all of the good feelings of the past year would continue. However, as we are about to see, rifts are going to appear inside the government. These rifts were not over just mere legislation, a controversial bill here and there, but rather was a debate over the very question of what the government was and what it should be. One of the key things that is going to come to explain the rift between the Hamilton and the Madison faction is how the two men themselves viewed the future for the country. Madison viewed the necessity of the government as being something of an arbitrator. They had to make sure that things were fair, settle disputes, but otherwise, mostly leave everybody else to their own devices. We know, of course, that Madison was very much in favor of a more energetic executive. However, in his mind, that power was meant to achieve the end of creating a government with the power to settle disputes. He had seen back during Shays' Rebellion the impotence of the government to mount any response, and that it took the Massachusetts merchants banding together to agree to pay for an army. James Madison understood what a serious problem this was and knew that the Union could not hold itself together if the national government couldn't even provide protections to its citizens. His vision of a more energetic government, therefore, was one that could provide those protections that one would expect from the government. Where Alexander Hamilton differed is that he thought nationally from the very beginning. Unlike so many others at the time, Hamilton was far less interested in the rights of the states and far more interested in what the United States as a single united entity could accomplish. This is perhaps unsurprising because Hamilton was not natively from the United States, having been raised in the West Indies. Remember that prior to the late imperial crisis, the states were very much individual entities that were all in competition with one another. This had been the case going back well over a century, and prior to the crisis with Great Britain, any attempts to draw the states closer had failed. Recall the very cold reception that Franklin's Albany Plan of Union had received back in the 1750s. Those feelings and connections to one state still ran very deep. Hamilton, though, had no such connections to any particular state, and was therefore able to view the United States more broadly. He did not want the government to just settle disputes. He instead was looking at a budding empire. What Hamilton envisioned was not a quiet country living out its existence across the Atlantic from the real power source in Europe. Rather, he viewed the United States as a great power, capable of meaningfully competing with those established great nations of the European order. With his spot at the top of the treasury, Hamilton had the ability to shape the commercial empire that he believed the United States should, and indeed was destined, to become. As Gordon Wood explains in his book, Empire of Liberty, Hamilton had good cause for believing that this was possible. England had as turbulent a 17th century as possible, having gone through the first English Civil Wars and then later the Glorious Revolution. They were a small country with a fraction of the resources of the new vast United States. And yet, they had risen up to become the foremost global power during the 18th century. Hamilton looked at this, nodded in approval, and said, "Yeah, I think we can do that too." What he narrowed in on as being the linchpin of British success was cooked into their financial system. Ideas like funded debts and banking, he believed, were the key to empire. Now, understand for a moment that the British financial system wasn't exactly popular, as was frequently pointed out by the political thinkers of the day, as being a source of deep, systemic governmental corruption. It was all believed to be an engine to give luxury to the rich at the expense of pretty much everybody else, and to drive a war machine that really very few wanted. So, as we are going to see in just a few minutes, the pushback to Hamilton's proposals were not just coming out of nowhere. What Hamilton wanted to do in the United States was something that was being blamed for corruption in the government in a country that had transformed into a global power. It isn't as though Americans were ignorant of this fact either. And indeed, it was pointed out plenty back during the run-up to the American Revolution. So, what exactly then was this grand plan of Hamilton's? The seeds for what would become the Report on Public Credit came directly from Congress when they established the Treasury Department. This had, in fact, been something of a point of contention to some in Congress, who themselves fought to maintain the power to issue the report themselves. However, it was with the approval of James Madison that the power should be given to the executive, and thus it fell into Hamilton's control. On January 9, 1790, Hamilton would deliver his Report on Public Debt, the first in a series of works that would come to define the future economy of the new nation. At the core of this debt was a call for the funding of a national debt and the assumption of the state's debt. The United States had a significant amount of debt heading into the 1790s. Wars are expensive, and the United States had basically survived the entire war on loans from the French and later the Dutch. Recall back to our episodes at the beginning of this season where we watched Robert Morris struggle to figure out some way to keep the lights on, which basically amounted to begging the French to extend an already wildly overstretched line of credit. This was all fine and well until the French ran headlong into their own financial cataclysm during the 1780s. That would, by the time the 1790s rolled around, evolve into their very own revolution. However, suffice it to say that the United States owed a whole boatload of money to foreign powers. Now, that part of the debt is actually the easy part of the debt to understand. The United States Congress had borrowed money. Hamilton knew just how much they had taken, what the servicing fees were, and pretty much exactly what the United States owed on that debt. Easy enough. That number came out to be right around $12 million. The problem, though, is that was not the only kind of debt that the Americans found themselves holding. There was an additional $42 million of debt that the United States owed to various people all throughout the country, for all kinds of things. Recall that back during the Revolution, the army would often head out and take those things necessary for the army, while providing some kind of a certificate of payment for it, ensuring that rather than an illegal seizure, just compensation was promised. There was likewise a whole other litany of other debts that the Continental Congress had racked up that they now owed. On top of all of that, the states themselves owed around 25 million of their own debt from the war. Whereas the 12 million owed to the American allies from the war, the remainder was not exactly subject to tidy bookkeeping and was a mishmash of receipts and ledgers that Hamilton, in his new capacity, was going to have to unwind. Everybody, including Hamilton, agreed that taking care of the debt was important and was something that the new government needed to get on top of. Now, Hamilton had to make some choices on exactly how to do this. There were some who thought that some of the domestic debt could be outright repudiated, meaning that the government basically says, yeah, we're not going to pay that. Sorry for ya. After all, back during the 1780s, a whole lot of debt had been purchased by speculators. So doing that would not exactly cheat innocent Americans, but rather would mostly affect those who had decided to take a risk anyway. Hamilton, though, shied away from this, worried that any such move would tank the nation's credit. In fact, Hamilton's plan believed it critical that not only did the debt get repaid, but that it was the national government, rather than the states, who was going to repay that debt. This is obviously a huge amount of debt that the federal government was, voluntarily, offering to assume. A federal government that, although seemingly on their way to being on better footing, was still significantly lacking in actual capital. So, what gives? Why was Alexander Hamilton suddenly wanting to take on so much extra debt? Well, as it turns out, this was all a big part of Hamilton's plan. Alexander Hamilton knew just how successful a well-funded debt could be. All he had to do was look at the former overlords and the British. Hamilton fully believed that if the United States could properly handle a debt, it would allow the country to borrow money at a far more affordable rate. To repay this newly acquired debt, the United States would set aside revenue at predictable intervals, which would then, in turn, be used to pay down the debt. This would, in effect, guarantee that the person loaning the money to the United States would be virtually guaranteed of repayment, thus establishing the credit of the United States. These government bonds, the instruments by which the government was going to be lending money, would have a set maturity date and clear, predictable terms. As soon as people could see that the government was meeting its debts, they would feel far more comfortable with the prospect of lending money, or buying bonds, to that government. The second advantage of this system is that in a country that was still cash poor, these bonds could circulate essentially as currency. If they were backed by the full faith and credit of the United States, which was Hamilton's full intention, then they could be openly sold and operate as a form of currency. The hope was further that with the credit of the United States quickly being restored, it would cause many of those bonds sold during the war to reappreciate, as the government sought to make good on its debt. Hamilton biographer Ron Chernow explains that this caused a bit of a stir, because many hated the fact that most of the government bonds from the Revolution had been sold to speculators for quick cash, often at pennies on the dollar. Although there were some who argued that the original bondholders, those who had risked so much for the country, should reap the benefits, Hamilton argued that the opposite was true. The speculators had trusted the United States enough to invest in it, whereas the soldiers who sold theirs had not trusted in the system. Now, whether Hamilton actually felt this way is more questionable. But what we do know is that by protecting the speculators' interest on this occasion, it would establish the precedent for freely transferable securities and would prove to be a limit on the government retroactively reaching in and toying with transactions. This brings us back full circle, though, to that original question. What does assuming the state's debts have to do with any of this? There were a couple of reasons for this. First, from a purely pragmatic standpoint, having the government cover all of the debts simplified everything. having a bunch of different entities, specifically the states, having their own plans to repay the debt was going to have a degree of chaos to it, which was very much opposed to the predictable order that Hamilton was trying to create. When trying to give investors confidence that the government was good for their debts, this gave them reassurance. Rather than having a system where the national government found itself referring people back to the individual states, they knew that the national government, well, that was where the buck stopped. Furthermore, there was the fact that you don't bite the hand that feeds. Hamilton believed that one of the best ways to secure allegiance to the new government was to make it a creditor. If the government owed all those merchants money, well, then the merchants were going to have to be at least nominally loyal to that government. Otherwise, they put their investments at risk. Had Hamilton not assumed state debt, it could have potentially created a situation where creditors found themselves having to compete between two interests, one being the individual states and the other being the national government. He recognized the dangers that could potentially come, putting creditors into a position of essentially having to deal with both the states and the federal government, when those two entities might not have aligning interests. More than that, though, Hamilton did not want to put the states into a place where they were forced to fight with the national government over tax revenue. Ideally, Hamilton wanted to keep state taxes as low as possible to avoid situations where either the United States might be forced to forgo a valuable levy because the state was already taxing a commodity. If the United States chose to push forward with a tax, despite the state already taxing an item, that would risk creating a tax load that was more than a manufacturer could handle. By eliminating such a large amount of debt, it meant that the states would have less of a reason to tax their citizens, freeing up additional revenue streams for the national government. Finally, what Hamilton was considering throughout this question over assumption was the very nature of the debt itself. Had the revolution, at least since the 1787 interpretation of it, not been an effort to create a new national government? The entire argument following the Constitution's creation was that the United States was just that, a group of states united under a common goal, rather than being 13 individual entities tied together through a loose confederation. More so, as Stanley Elkins and Eric McKittrick explain, this had been cooked into the original Articles of Confederation. The national government was always meant to pay back the war debts, because there was a need for this effort not to be characterized as the states acting individually, but rather acting together. Of course, we know that during the 1780s, there was never a meaningful way that the national government could have paid for anything, let alone the war debts. With no independent method of raising revenue, the Confederation's government had no way to cover that debt. Now, though, with Hamilton's plan, he could finally make good on the promise and ensure that the United States was the focal point of repayment. The problem, and one that is going to cause so much strife, is that not everybody was thrilled with this plan, as is the case today. Whenever there are discussions about wide-scale debt forgiveness, people who already paid off their debts get really annoyed when it is suggested that their fiscal responsibility be rewarded with others seeing their debts simply evaporate into nothingness. This problem was further complicated because in many cases, the records didn't exist, or a state would authorize an action during the war that Congress itself did not. Think back to the irregular frontier war in the South. It was undeniably a critical part of the war, but often it was not something that was following a specific plan or congressional authorization. So, do those debts get included in the assumption? Hamilton, however, had thought of this as well, and he had a plan. The accounting was going to be a beast, that was certain. The plan, therefore, was simple. The federal government would assume all of the state debt. That way, there was no question or nitpicking over what had and had not been congressionally approved. Further, the government would offer states that had paid off their debt relief in the form of reimbursements. As a bit of extra security, Hamilton would also create a sinking fund, which was designed to siphon off some money right off the top of an organization in order to repay the loans. Here, Hamilton took from post office revenue enough money to retire about 5% of the debt every year. A further guarantee that an investment in the United States was a sound financial move. More than just this, however, Hamilton also had to figure out at what rate the debts should be repaid at. At the rate that they were originally at, 6%, the Treasury simply lacked the money to service the loans. Hamilton wanted a well-funded public debt, but he needed that number to be manageable enough that the economy could grow, something that would be stifled at such a high rate. Now, on the matter of foreign debt, those loans were generally down at a lower 4-5% rate. So Hamilton decided that those could just be taken care of. The bigger problem was the domestic debt, which came in at 6%. What Hamilton decided on was a partial system of repudiation of the rates. Although, as Ron Chernow points out, he avoided the use of that term like the plague. Instead, what Hamilton did was offer up a few options when it came to repayment, which included trading an amount of interest for land, although only a few of his proposed options ever actually made it into law. Regardless, though, Hamilton understood that there was simply no way that this debt could be paid back at a full 6% without harming the economy, and as a result, decided that the Continental debt would instead be set at a much more manageable 4%. With all of this new debt, there remained a very obvious necessity for the Department of the Treasury. Simply put, they actually had to pay the debts. In order to do that, Hamilton envisioned a whole set of new taxes on certain luxury items. Hamilton readily acknowledged that such taxes might have a negative effect on consumption, but argued that this would largely be negated because people really like their luxuries. To further help with what he knew was going to be a bitter pill, he reasoned that most of these things were going to be increased taxes on foreign luxuries anyway. There would be an exception to these taxes being levied primarily against foreign luxuries that I do want to take just a moment to mention. One of the things that he proposed a tax on was wines and spirits that were made within the United States. Now, not to be giving away too much of a spoiler here, but especially with that tax when it came to whiskey, oh boy, are people going to have feelings about that. But that is a story for another day. Alexander Hamilton did not view this plan to have a well-funded national debt as a plan to necessarily have a permanent standing debt, something that all of us living in the modern United States recognize as a political reality. Rather, he viewed it as a temporary way to get the country onto steadier financial ground and as a means to jumpstart the economy. Hamilton was not blind to the fact that the United States did not possess an economy on par with any of the European nations. Instead, what he saw was the potential of the future United States. He knew that the United States was a vast country with a large population and huge amounts of resources. The task before him, therefore, was setting up a system that would encourage that growth and would foster a system that could compete economically with any other power on Earth. It is not as though Hamilton loved the idea of having debt in the long term. In fact, he was quite clear on the point that all debt needed to be eventually retired. In this situation, though, he recognized that a carefully crafted, well-organized debt would help set the United States up on a path for both present and future success. In time, Hamilton would come to fear the accumulation of public debt, as it quickly became apparent that things were maybe not getting taken care of as quickly as he would have liked. I'm going to leave things here for now, not because there is not enough to say on the matter, but instead because there is still so much to discuss. As I mentioned at the top of the episode today, this is going to have long-ranging consequences for the politics of the nation. Today we talked about the pragmatic, what exactly it was that Hamilton was proposing. What we have not yet touched on is why this is going to prove to be such a lightning rod for dissent and exactly what those reactions are going to look like. Next time, we are going to, probably unsurprisingly, start looking at the reaction to Hamilton's proposal and what everybody thought it meant for the future. Until then, I hope you all have a wonderful 2 weeks. I hope that you are staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you back here next time as everybody reacts to Hamilton's grand plan.